This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can gaze into the face of a terrible bureaucracy, the intellectuals who supported Nazi plans for the Holocaust.
He's the person organizing in the background in early 41 about the deployment of the Einsatzgruppen, mobile killing squads.
ISU history professor Katrine Paler has a new book on Walter Schellenberg and Nazi intelligence services. Plus, Ryan Denham reports on a new way to keep historic buildings in Bloomington from the wrecking ball. Laura Kennedy brings you the annual children's opera from Prairie Fire Theater. And musician and high school teacher Stefan Robinson tells us where he got his real education, on the road in a hip-hop group. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The city of Bloomington has found a new way to save really old properties. The city is marking May's National Preservation Month by rolling out its new demolition review process. As Bloomington city planner Katie Simpson tells GLT's Ryan Denham, it's all about educating homeowners.
You know, nothing's really changed about what people can and cannot do with their properties. The demolition can still occur, but what it does is if we're looking at if the city or the homeowner, or if it's a commercial building and the property owner is looking to demolish something that is over 500 square feet and over 50 years old and potentially, you know, historically significant, whether it represents local architecture, maybe it was home to somebody who was famous, maybe it was maybe it represents a significant period in Bloomington's cultural and social evolution, then it would be reviewed by the Preservation Commission to see if there's any way to come up with an alternative to demolition. And then if no alternative can be reached, then the property owner could still move forward with demolition.
How did this new demolition review process come about?
This was adopted on March 11th when the city adopted its new zoning ordinance. You know, when we were going through the comprehensive plan process in 2013, 2014, 2015, historic preservation was really identified as a significant goal for the community. You know, Bloomington is unique because of its history. That's what separates us from other places in Illinois and other places in the United States. You know, we really want to focus on promoting heritage tourism and looking at ways that we could maintain neighborhood character. And so this is one tool that will give the community an opportunity to kind of stop and breathe before we tear down something that we may not have to tear down.
So as you as this process kind of rolls along, and let's say the Historic Preservation Commission does flag it as potentially historically significant, and so that triggers a discussion about alternatives. I guess what are some of those alternatives? What are, you know, the funding options, the grants that may exist? What is sort of in that menu of things that the city could offer up to a property owner?
Part of the process, you know, we would also notify neighbors. And so in some cases, we've had instances in the city where a neighborhood has come together to buy a house that they didn't want to see torn down. And so they've bought it, and they have, this was in the East Grove Historic District, and they really came together to fix it up using, you know, their own knowledge of historic homes. Another option could be to look at pursuing local designation, which would qualify the property owner for funding through the FUNC grant. If it's in our downtown district, there may be funding available through the RUST grant. If it's in an enterprise zone, you know, that's another potential incentive that the property owner may not have been aware of that they could utilize. If the building has potential for National Register designation, you know, that's a process that, depending on the building and its location, you know, maybe the city would be able to help the property owner go through that process to have it put on the National Register, and then there's additional funding options that could come available to the property owner, such as tax freezes or tax credits, which can be used to restore property to. So it's really about looking at, it's on a case-by-case basis and looking at, you know, what is the best, what is an alternative that's feasible for this specific property that can create a win-win for both the property owner and the city. And in some cases, you know, the answer might just be demolition. You might have a building that's just not safe. You know, it's an eyesore. It's causing property values to drop in the neighborhood. And so maybe it's demolition.
Potentially significant. How is that defined, like, actually in words? Like, what are the things that could trigger that, a potentially significant recommendation?
The section it's referencing is the criteria for local designation. So, you know, we look at whether or not its character, interest, or value is part of the development, heritage, or cultural characteristics of the city, the county, the state, the United States. So looking at whether or not really it's significant on a local level, maybe it's significant on a United States level, maybe Abraham Lincoln, you know, practiced law there as an example. You know, looking at if it has architectural features or represents an architectural style that is worth preserving, whether it shows building materials that were local to Bloomington, if it embodies design elements that make it structurally or architecturally innovative, whether or not it's something that can provide an educational benefit in the future, really. If there's something to learn from preserving this structure, then it's probably a good building or structure to save.
Have there been properties in the past and in the recent past that have been demolished that the city or the city elected officials have, in retrospect, this type of thing would have been really applicable in those cases? There have been buildings that we've lost that maybe we didn't need to lose?
Honestly, there have. In 2000, the Old House Society published a great book that highlights a lot of those properties. It's called Bloomington Normal Lost. There's, we can point out a few, on Main Street. There was one that was a George Miller building. It was Romanesque architecture, you know, and Queen Anne style Romanesque architecture. And it was torn down in the 1930s to be a Piggly Wiggly. And now it's used as a commercial use, commercial building. So that's one example. There's plenty of other ones. I can also think of ones where, you know, where we've been able to save some resources because we followed a process similar to this, even though it wasn't codified. So, for example, the city in 2007 actually picked up and moved a house off of a piece of property rather than tearing it down. And I think that's a great example of when people come together and explore alternatives to just the demolition, when we stop and take that breath. That we can come up with a solution that allows us to be creative and still save that architecture and that home and then utilize the space where it once was.
So are there certain parts of the city where this demolition review process will come, like, most in handy?
Our comprehensive plan identified the preservation area, basically everything that is east of downtown until you get to some of probably about Towanda. You know, so that would be that area encompasses a lot of our National Register districts. We have 6 local historic districts, historic areas, and so the majority of them are located in that area. We would really focus on, you know, preserving what we have there versus preserving something that's already lost its integrity or never had integrity in the first place. Mm-hmm.
So, closing thoughts here. As a city planner, I mean, someone whose job is to literally think about Bloomington's future, why is it important for the past to be part of that future?
Bloomington's history is its identity, right? So that's what separates us from other places. And so National Preservation Month is a chance for the city to celebrate its history and its identity, and to honor those who are taking efforts to preserve that identity, you know, for future residents of Bloomington.
That's Bloomington City Planner Katie Simpson with GLT's Ryan Denham. The Bloomington and Normal Historic Preservation Commissions presented their awards this past week at the McLean County Museum of History. Winners included Greg Coos, recognized as Preservationist of the Year. Bloomington Township earned the Landscape Restoration Award for its work at Evergreen Cemetery.
Support for GLT comes from Dr. Matt Fraker and his staff at the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center, protecting the human companion animal bond, caring for life of all kinds, and proud supporter of the Parklands Foundation. Details about Parklands Nature Preserves at 454-8606. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a teacher who grew up hating school. How did he really learn? He'll tell you on the road in a hip-hop group. That's from the next edition of A Story Slam Story. Old music, new words, uplifting stories. That's the simple formula for Prairie Fire Theater's yearly children's opera, which plays at area schools throughout May. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy spoke with a local writer who penned the storyline and libretto and aims to awaken a passion for music.
The performers, director, crew, and writer of Prairie Fire Theater's How to Be a Superhero work together to assemble part of the brightly painted set.
I got a rolling pin.
Honestly? Yeah. Honestly, that'll work.
Well, maybe.
Yay.
So that's what you need the hammer for.
Teamwork.
It's a cheery, egalitarian manifestation of, hey kids, let's put on a show. Only this show is not by kids, but for kids. It's the latest children's opera from Prairie Fire Theater. How to Be a Superhero explores the importance of dreams and how to be true to oneself. For the ninth year, writer Nancy Steele Brokaw has teamed with the theater to not only provide area school kids with a fun theatrical experience, but to also expose them to what Brokaw calls some of the most glorious music in the world.
A driving force for quite a few of us is just a feeling that this music has been around for 400 years, the music of Mozart, Puccini, Rossini, and it was written for the masses, and we think kids ought to get some exposure to it.
But they're not getting it at school?
We all know arts funding has been cut and cut and cut, and a lot of kids don't get to see live theater or hear real music, especially opera music, sung. And so we pack the show up and bring it to them with the idea that we want this music to continue, so we want to build audience for classical music. But also, we want kids to know, and a lot of them don't, that it might be something they want to do. Sing, act, build sets, make props, write stories. And so at the end of every performance, Bob Mangliardi says to the kids, if this looks like something you might like to do, it will be there for you in junior high and high school. And through the years, a lot of kids, in fact, have followed that passion that for a lot of kids they didn't even know existed. So that's a reason we do it. We think we've got a good message to bring as far as the arts having relevant value. We always have some morals built into the story, something of higher value that we think will help build good citizens and share our story. And for the Westland kids who are part of this, it's just a great exposure to their craft. It's like vaudeville. They have to load up the set, move it school to school, unload it, and play it. You know, we're, I think, doing almost 50 performances in a little over three weeks. So it's intense. And if you can hold a crowd of 500 kids sitting wiggly on a gym floor, you can do anything. And our a lot of our students who've done this have gone on, you know, professionally or to grad school and come back and said, this is one of the best things I ever did.
This is your ninth kids' opera that you have done the libretto for and written the story for. Where do you find your inspiration?
I don't know. I really don't know. I always have ideas. The problem is, are they good ones, and can I make a story out of them? But this year, I had this idea in my head that what if the things we get teased for can make us strong? We all know that there's a lot of teasing and bullying that go on, and it always have, but it's worse with social media. And oftentimes the things that we get teased for as adults, we go back and, you know, like I was a big reader as a kid. I got teased for that, but, you know, kind of worked out for me. So that was the idea that was in my head this year. And then, I don't know, I sort of dream up the characters, and then they usually kind of, in a weird way, tell me what they want to do.
So the opera this year is called How to Be a Superhero, and it's very well timed, what with the new Avengers movie coming out. Did you do that on purpose?
No, I didn't. But kids love superheroes. And we did a superhero one a few years ago called Whoosh, Web of Opera Superheroes. But in that show, the superheroes had superpowers. And in this story, I wanted the kids to find that superpower within themselves. The story's about the nerd club, three kids who are teased, one for being bookish and one gal that's really into gadgets and building things, and one gal who's a theater kid. And in fact, those things that they've been teased for, they turn into superheroes in a kind of magical way because they end up in capes.
So you've created this nerd club with your characters. Would you be a member of the nerd club yourself there, Nancy?
That's a good question. Probably. Not sure about that. Maybe everybody's a little bit of a member of a nerd club in some way or other. So, yeah, I probably would be.
What are some of the lessons you're trying to impart with this?
One thing we talk about this year is being your own true self. I think that's always been an important thing and a hard thing for kids to figure out, how to be their own best self. That's one thing. Another thing we talk about is helping each other, because the nerd club needs to come together as a team to defeat the dastardly villain.
You have Bob Mantegna playing your villain this year, because I have a feeling he just, every year, that's on his calendar, like, yeah, I get to play the villain.
I think it totally is on his calendar. He's the best bad guy baritone in all the world. And he's been the bad guy all the years I've written it. And the kids in the schools, a lot of them know him. And he always has these lines where he says, and do you know why I did that? Because I'm the bad guy. And then the kids hold up their thumbs and go, and he'll just walk in and they start doing that. Yeah, he's a good bad guy. But I do always redeem him in the end.
So that's very important that there is redemption in your stories.
Yeah, I always redeem the bad guy. And in this case, turns out the reason he's snatching everyone's dreams is because he's never had any dreams of his own. And he kind of gets one at the end. And so does, this year we have an inanimate character, a Mashbox, that mashes up people's dreams. It's kind of a Alexa meets Audrey 2 from Little Shop of Horrors. So it's a mechanical box that talks and also sings Mozart.
Oh, now let's get into that. Some of your choices with the music. You have actually taken classics and composed new words to these classics. You have a lot of Mozart and a lot of Arthur Sullivan. Tell me about your choices.
When we're thinking about music, at least I always think of the fifth grade boys in the back of the bleachers and what's going to hold their attention. And so often the answer to that is Mozart or anything that moves really fast. Sometimes we put an aria in, but we usually cut it to a minute and a half or 2 minutes tops and have action going on at the same time, because they're wiggly kids at the end of the school year. So the action has to come really fast.
So do you spend the year trying to find new things, or do you have a really strong background in classical music, a good repertoire from which to choose?
No, I don't have a great background, although now I've spent a long time doing this. And I do a lot of research, and that's really fun for me. I have an idea of the feeling I want in the song, and I have lots of musical friends that I can ask for ideas. And eventually, a tune just feels right.
So do you choose the song first and then write around it, or do you have an idea for a song and you have to go out and find the music that'll fit that mood?
Yes.
Okay.
The answer's both, kind of at the same time.
When you're composing and coming up with these songs. Is it a challenge to speak the language of children?
Luckily for me, I write a lot of shows that involve kids throughout the year, so I'm around kids a lot, and I actually listen to that and will ask them.
So you're hep to that.
I try to be. I doubt that they'd say that, but I try to be. But one thing I don't ever do is talk down to kids. If I think a big word is the right word, I'll throw it in there. And then we actually send I write it. It's a curriculum guide that goes around to all the schools. And if we have, you know, some big words or more difficult concepts, we explain them there. But I think, you know, kids like a good story. They like a bad guy. They love a chase through the gym or the bleachers. And so that's in there.
Wait a minute. See, it goes off stage and into the audience?
Oh, yeah. It totally goes off stage. It's always Bob chasing one or two of the characters. Like in Washington School, where there's a balcony, they'll even go up into the balcony, run around, and come back down. And our brilliant pianist can just keep vamping on, I think this year's the Anvil Chorus, just keep vamping on the chase song while they run through, and they'll sit down in the middle of the gym with all the kids, and it's hilarious and fun.
That's Nancy Steele Brokaw. Prairie Fire Theater presents How to Be a Superhero Saturday at 10 a.m. at Normal Public Library and 3 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church. It's also running Wednesday at 10 and 11:30 a.m. at the Normal Theater. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see some behind-the-scenes photos of the opera at our website, wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 and wglt.org.
GLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State is consistently ranked among the top universities nationwide by U.S. News & World Report, which cites Illinois State's academic quality and excellence. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 GLT and wglt.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a tale of bureaucracy, a horrendous, brutal bureaucracy dedicated to killing. Stephen Robinson is a father, partner, musician, teacher, and revolutionary. He's also a pretty rad dude. Thing is, he grew up hating school. He now teaches high school, by the way, and he shares a story about his real education, life on the road in a touring hip-hop group. This came from a recent Next to Normal Story Slam at the McLean County Arts Center.
Yeah, I used to tour with this hip-hop duo, and I think I learned more doing that than I ever learned in school. The very first night of the very first tour we ever went on, we were in a place called Blissfield, Michigan. Has anybody ever been to Blissfield, Michigan? No, probably not. It's a tiny town, and we weren't actually playing a show in the town. We were playing a show outside of town in what was a church, but people were squatting in it, and we showed up to the show. We were on tour with a band called Rapider Than Horsepower. That's the best name ever, isn't it? Rapider Than Horsepower. They're from Bloomington, Indiana. They're a punk band. And yeah, we were the kind of rap group that played with punk bands. Whenever we played with another rap group, we just felt off. We played a show in Atlanta once. No. This was Athens, Georgia, with this like Dirty South rap group. I don't know if you know what the Dirty South hip hop sounds like, but. And this dude came up to me after the show and asked me if I would sell him beats. And I was like, no, I'm not going to sell you any beats. Sorry. Anyway, that's not a part of the story. We rolled into Blissfield, Michigan with Rapider Than Horsepower, rolled up to this church, and it's us and like eight metal bands and Rapider Than Horsepower. And Moses, a.k.a. Kid Static, I think must have been the first black dude they'd seen in months. And he's a rapper from Chicago, born and raised in Chicago. We roll up, and I think they assumed things about him that made him seem instantly cool. And he was an instant celebrity. First night, very first tour. And I'm just like, I'm here too. But the show went well. It went well. We played, some metal bands played, Rapper Than Horsepower played, and I was thirsty, so I went to one of the guys that lived in the house. I was like, hey, man, where can I fill up my bottle of water? And the guy said, oh, there's no functional plumbing in this building. I was like, what? Don't you live here? Yeah. I was like, what do you drink? They had a lot of alcohol, and that was it. I don't drink alcohol. I never have. So I was, I guess I'm not going to hydrate tonight. So I went outside to be by myself and finish a sandwich that I had purchased earlier in the day. I had about a half of a sandwich left, and I'm sitting there eating my sandwich. Enjoying myself. You like that one? And this guy starts walking up to me. Here, somebody imagine. Come here, Tristan. Imagine you're me. Eat your sandwich, okay? Yeah. This guy walks up to me like this. I'm not very big. Yeah, you can sit down. Thank you. I don't know how big he was, but he was a lot bigger than me. And drunk. And I don't really like inebriated people. And so I'm standing there. He comes walking up. Very intimidating. Getting in my... Okay, imagine the chair's me now. Bumps into me. And I say, can I just eat my sandwich, please? And he says... This is what he said to me. Eat your sandwich. Kick your sandwich. And so I thought, all right, I'm about to get my sandwich kicked right now by a very large drunk fellow in the middle of nowhere in Michigan. And I've never been in a fight in my life, and I don't know what I'm going to do. Where's Moses? Kid Static. But at that precise moment, Mike A comes walking up. Mike A is a singer from Rapper Than Horsepower, not to be confused with Mike D, who played guitar in Rapper Than Horsepower. Mike A walks up. Mike A is also a large fellow, scraggly hair, tattoos on the backs of his hands and his neck, you know, like the type of dude that can only get a job working in a kitchen, because I'm just being honest. he can't get employed anywhere else. And he's a singer in this band. The sweetest dude in the world. When you get to know him, he's super sweet, but, you know, in the dark, he doesn't look sweet. So he walks up behind me, and I'm like his little buddy, you know. And he's like, is there a problem here? And then the Eat Your Sandwich guy just sort of, you know, saunters off. So at that point, this is the first night of the first tour I ever went on. At that point, Mike A's like, all right, let's go get paid. I'm like, cool. All right. So we go find the promoter. The promoter turns out to be a 14-year-old kid. Like, all right, where's the kid at? He's sitting on the steps to the church, and we come up. He's sitting there, and Mike A is doing the talking. I don't know what I'm doing. Mike A has been living on the road for years, so I'm just like, let him handle it. He says to the kid, hey, you know, we want to settle up. And the kid says, yeah. We only got like $25 for you. I don't know what the agreement was for that night, but I know that wasn't it. And Mike A, without missing a beat, leaned over him. That wasn't the agreement. And the kid popped up, ran into the church, and came out in less than 2 minutes with all of the money. And then the dude left, scampered off, and Mike A looked at me and said, sometimes that's how you gotta do it. It's like, what? Don't people just treat you fairly? I don't understand sometimes you have to do what? Then we were trying to figure out where we were going to sleep, because the 14-year-old kid apparently told us we could sleep in the church. So I go into the church. I got my sleeping bag. Walk up. I see Moses coming out of the basement, and Moses looks at me. Moses knows me pretty well by this point. He's like a brother to me now, but at this point, we weren't like brothers yet. We just knew each other really well. He comes out of the basement, and he looks at me and goes, "You don't want to go down there." And I was like, yeah, but the kid, the 14-year-old kid told me that's where we were sleeping. Nope. Where are you going to sleep? I'm going back down. And I was like, wait, what? Why do you get to go down there and sleep and I don't? Yeah, man, you don't want to go down there. I was like, okay. I did find out what was going on down there eventually, and he was right. So he saved me. So I find Mike A. I'm like, Mike A, what are we going to do? We need to go to sleep. You know, I'm like, hey, big guy, I need help figuring out what I'm going to do my first night on the road. And he's like, I think Mike Dixon has a tent in the car, or in the van. Okay, let's go get the tent. Mike Dixon gets the tent. He's like, yeah, the tent's for one person. It's a one-person tent. Can we sleep in it with you? Okay. All right. So we put up this tiny little tent in the middle of this yard. Middle of nowhere. There's no lights, no running water, no nothing. Set up the tent. Mike Dixon gets in. I feel like by the time I got in the tent, he was already asleep. I almost cursed, but I didn't because my kid's here. I'm on my best behavior when he's here. You should hear me at school when he's not with us. It's like, God, I have a problem. So Mike Dixon is in the tent, already asleep. Mike A gets into the tent. Mike A is the biggest dude. I don't know why he decided to sleep in the middle. He gets in, and then I get in. There's no room for me. I'm laying there by the door. I don't think. And then I look over. Eat Your Sandwich Man is by a tree looking at me. He's just sitting there like this. So I look over at Mike A. Oh, is my time up? Oh, that's the song. Yeah. I was like, what is this, the Emmys? I look over at Mike A. I was like, Mike A. There it is. Yeah, we actually wrote a song about it. That's the song. I look over at him. Mike A. I don't think I'm going to be able to sleep. He's staring at us. And Mike A just said, take off your belt. And I was like, what? Why? Just take it off. No, take off your belt. I was like, okay. So I start taking off my belt. I don't know why. And then he said, wrap it around your hand. Okay. Let the buckle dangle like 4 inches. Okay. Now lay down, go to sleep. I was like, okay. And then he said, he like whispered this in my ear. He's like, look, man, I know you can't fight. So if something happens, just swing your arm around and let the buckle hit him. And then I'll step in and save you. And I was like, okay. So I laid down. That guy was still there. And then I fell asleep somehow. I woke up the next day. The sun was out. My hand was still clenching the belt. It was all white. Mike A and Mike D were both asleep. I was like, we survived. I don't know how. So then, like two tours after that, I'm in Columbus, Ohio, playing this house party. We're on a tour with a different band. They're called the May She. They're super good, another punk band. And after the show, I was the guy that was responsible for the money on this tour. This dude comes out, the promoter. Again, he was a college kid, so he was older than 14, but he was still pretty young. He came out, and I was like, hey, man, we need to settle up. I need to hit the road. And he said to me, we didn't collect enough money. This is all I have. And I thought, what would Mike A do? And I said, you better go in there and get it. And then what did I? And then he was like, okay. And then I thought to myself, what is happening to me? He did get money. He found money somewhere, came out. Me and that dude actually became friends, and he became our merch man on a subsequent tour. Another Mike. His name was Mike Pham. But at that, in one of, is those moments where I started to realize I can't do this. I can't. All I want to do is make music, but I cannot do it in a way where I have to spend my time trying to shake down kids for another $50, so I can get to the next town and shake down some other college kid for another $50. It's like, what is the point? And at the same time, I was starting to get sort of, conscious of the world. I'm at another mic. There's mics all over the place. Is there a mic here tonight? Are there any mics? Yeah? There's got to be at least a mic, one mic here. Anyway, I met another mic in Philadelphia. This mic was an anarchist, and we played a show at his house, and I was like, what? Tell me about your life. He loaned me books, and I was like, what is the, we met these like dudes in Georgia, we met people out west, and I started to think, I need to do something else with my life. So we went back to Chicago after one of these tours, and I said to Moses, I think I'm going to go back to school and become a teacher. And he said, I guess I'm moving to L.A. And that's what he did. So now I do that. I still do music. Moses and I put a record out a couple years ago, but we don't tour anymore. But now when my students ask me, Mr. Robinson, man, I don't know what I'm going to do next year. I'm thinking about going to college. I'm thinking about doing, I should get a, now I always say, no. What you need to do is start a band and tour for like 3 years. Then you'll figure out what you really want to do with your life. Like, Mr. Robinson, I don't play any instruments. That's okay. I literally hit play on a laptop and ran around and yelled for 3 years. You don't have to know how to do anything to do that. Have you heard what's on the radio? Oh, yeah. So far, none of them have taken me up on my advice. But someday they will.
Stephan Robinson told his story at a Next to Normal Story Slam produced by Devin Lovell at the McLean County Arts Center. The theme of the next Story Slam this evening at the center is Isn't It Romantic? This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's take you behind the scenes in the horrible Nazi bureaucracy. Katrine Paler is an ISU history professor who has published a book on the Third Reich's intelligence service, in particular, the career of a man named Walter Schellenberg, the head of the Foreign Intelligence Service, or Department 6. Paler says she was interested in Nazi intellectuals, a whole group of young men who entered the SS, Himmler's secret police, and entered the security service. Paler says she was interested in them because they were different from the run-of-the-mill Nazis who entered the party early and rose through the ranks.
Different about them is their education. So we're talking about university-educated people here to quite some extent. That is very different from many other high Nazi officials. So that makes them unusual. What also makes them unusual is the way they sell their commitment, the way they talk about their commitment or don't talk about their commitment to Nazi Germany. So the way how they portray themselves at the time and then after the war as well. So that's where I would locate the main difference.
Are they common as a class about the shifting ground? It's initially portraying themselves as true believers and then fighting their bureaucratic battles and then after the war saying, oh, it was something else. I just had to do it because that was how you had to act in my country.
Let's just say they're common enough. They're common enough, but they also, these are not the men that after the war define the image of Nazi Germany. What defines the image is the brown shirt, the SA person. What defines the image is the, to some extent, crazy, or what seems to be very crazy from the outside. So it's not these particular men who define the image. And that was to some extent what drew me to that, this particular group of people which assembles, gathers in the SD, and becomes quite important there.
So talk about Schellenberg. He started out as a medical student and then switched to law and joined the Nazi Party in 1933 and very quickly became a rising star. What made him that rising star and similar to this class of young intellectuals that you're looking at?
Well, he claimed to be a medical student. Actually, I haven't found that in the records. So what I can tell from the records is that he was always a student of law.
Why claim that?
Because it made for a good story after the war. That so Schellenberg survives the war. He is put on trial in the subsequent trials at Nuremberg, gets a few years in prison, gets out early, writes an autobiography, which is an autobiography very much written for the West German post-war public and for the Anglophone public. So here he is telling a story of a young man who had this humanist leaning of sorts, wanted to be a medical student, but decided to study law because it was the more prudent decision, financially more prudent decision. And I just find it interesting. It's a throwaway line in his autobiography, and it shows up in lots and lots of books on where he is mentioned. It's a small thing, but I went into his records, student records, and there's no indication that he ever studied medicine.
Small details matter in crafting a legend. What other kinds of things popped out at you when you took a detailed look at his life that were false or served to shape his narrative?
The way how he talks about his family or doesn't talk about his family or what he then decides to share about the family. So he very much crafts his narrative before 1933 of a young man who is comes from a family that was battered very hard by the end of World War One and the reparations. So he's feeding into this whole myth.
But you're making the point that he paid his tuition on time and he was pretty stable in his finances.
Yes, he was. I mean, I can't tell where his money is coming from, but he's always paying his tuition on time. So you can see from the matriculation box where he signs up and they basically put in a check mark if you pay. And he pays in full each and every time. And there's also this really intriguing decision for him to go to this particular university where he's going at that point in time. So that is the first career move he's making.
It's a quality university in Marburg.
It's a quality university. It's also a university which is at that point known for radical right-wing politics among the students.
So he's already tacking.
Yes, he's not involved with the Nazis at that point, but he also gets himself involved with a very prestigious fraternity. So, you know, you can see the social climber there, the social political climber very early on, and I find it quite fascinating. And not that religion is the most important point. For all I know, he never was particularly religious, but he came from a Catholic background. Marburg is the oldest Protestant university in all of Germany. Very proudly so. It doesn't mean that you can't be Catholic to go to that university, but there is a statement in there. For a person of that background from that part of the country going to this university at that point in time.
It's a cultural statement.
It's also a political statement, mm-hmm. I would argue.
Okay.
More so than a cultural statement.
So is he common? Is he a type of striver here who fashions themselves and creates almost a con?
I wouldn't quite call it a con, but I would argue that he's very much part and parcel of this group of youngish men who try very hard to make their way.
So in a lot of bureaucratic apparatuses, and the intelligence services of Nazi Germany are a bureaucratic apparatus, full of infighting, as you make clear here, full of navel gazing, in addition to looking outside according to their mission statements. In a lot of cultures like that, you're not going to get such a concentration of strivers, of myth makers about themselves. You're going to get some people like that, but you're going to also have careerists. You're also going to have people who believe in mission. You're looking at this class and saying, these rose to the top almost uniformly. What about Nazi Germany made these folks' ascension more prevalent than in other places, perhaps?
Nazism was to quite some extent a youth movement. So it was a really good place for young and ambitious men to make careers well fast. Everybody was young. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is a very important point we tend to lose sight of, how ridiculously young everyone was. And it was also a world in which the world was created anew. So radical ideas could find more than a hearing, could find support. The eminent British historian Ian Kershaw talks about working towards a Führer. So working towards a leader, anticipating what the leader wants. If you're good at that, you can make a career in Nazi Germany. And if you are able to navigate this difficult, somewhat difficult in-between time, the move from a bureaucracy that originated in the Weimar Republic into the new bureaucracy, if you can navigate that and talk about that smartly and are both ideological and pragmatic, you're basically golden.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with ISU history professor Katrin Paehler about her book, The Third Reich's Intelligence Services, The Career of Walter Schellenberg. One of the ways in which he worked toward the Führer was to hitch himself to Himmler. How did that work?
Schellenberg is really good at finding patrons all through his career. So he makes this very rapid rise, even for Nazi standards, through the SD by basically finding himself always a patron who is one or two steps ahead of himself and proving himself to that person. And the most important here before Himmler, and I'll get to him in a moment, is actually Heydrich, Reinhard Heydrich. And Heydrich finds himself in a bit of a predicament in 37, 38, 39. And it's trying to figure out how this new bureaucracy of Nazi Germany is going to look. So the question becomes, are the new bureaucrats of the state to be, are they going to be political soldiers, meaning ideologues, or are they going to be, let's put it like this, traditionally trained bureaucrats? And it has to do obviously with a bureaucracy, but for the men who are in the middle of this, it also has to do with state positions, state pensions, what qualifications does one need to do what. So Schellenberg, to quite some extent, is the political soldier, the ideologue. But Schellenberg, having studied law, he can also make the law argument. So he is the man in between, who decides to throw in his lot very early on with Heydrich, because he seems to be very good at reading the environment, reading the room, and Heydrich is the coming man.
Apart from that, you also have your external mission. It's a foreign intelligence service that he's starting to head. Did he deliver?
No. Next question.
Okay.
It was an epic failure as an intelligence service. What makes this particular intelligence service so interesting is that it's a completely new outfit within the SD. It's sometimes called Amt Ausland, sometimes Office 6, depending on what year you are in. And they envision this as a political foreign intelligence service. And political here very much means that everybody comes out of the Nazi worldview. There was no shortage of intelligence services in Germany. So there's a traditional Abwehr, the military intelligence service, and much of what Office 6, Amt 6 wanted to do was to collect political intelligence, and that to quite some extent was done by the diplomatic services. So it was a crowded field, to say the least. The claim to fame was that they are more ideological, that they are more Nazified, that they know how to do it right. They knew how to interpret the world in the proper sense.
Is this a cautionary tale about allowing ideology to shape your product and make it ineffective?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the epitome of a cautionary tale when it comes to screwing up intelligence collection.
Give a couple examples, would you?
Say, for example, they're looking at Hungary. And every problem they see with a German ally of Hungary is focused on the Jewish influence in Hungary that still exists, according to the SD, in 1940. So they are also then making policy prescriptions in a way that might please Himmler, Hitler. And the same, you see it mostly in the reporting, the same way they look at the United States. And at a certain point, there's a list going around of people in the United States and politicians who might support Nazi Germany. And basically, it is a wish list. A wish list also in the sense that everybody who isn't for Roosevelt is going to be for Hitler.
It does not follow.
Yes, it does not follow, but there's very much this ideological thinking here.
He tended his myth even after he got out of prison, and he got a very light prison sentence, as you make the point. How did he do that?
He got this very light prison sentence because he managed to portray himself as a humanist and what I call a thwarted bringer of peace. Because in the last month of the war, Schellenberg was actually engaged in, I'm trying to find the words carefully here, engaged in peace soundings with Western allies.
Is that legitimate, or is that him reading the political winds and deciding, I'm going to become a refugee and position myself here?
I think it's all of the above.
Katrin Paylor is the author of The Third Reich's Intelligence Services, The Career of Walter Schellenberg, out from Cambridge University Press. She's a professor of history at Illinois State University. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. I'm Charlie Schlenker.